A reading from the book of Isaiah. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain, and spreads them like a tent to live in, who brings princes to naught, and makes the rulers of the earth as nothing. Scarcely are they planted, scarcely sown, scarcely has their stem taken root in the earth. When he blows upon them and they wither, and the tempest carries them off like stubble. To whom then will you compare me, or who is my equal? Says the Holy One. Lift up your eyes on high and see, who created these? He who brings out their host and numbers them, calling them all by name. Because he is great in strength, mighty in power, not one is missing. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel? My way is hidden from Yahweh, and my right is disregarded by my God. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Yahweh is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the faint and strengthens the powerless. Even youths will faint and be weary, and the young will fall exhausted. But those who wait for Yahweh shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, according to He Shows Goodwill. Long ago, in the time before all days, before the creation of all things, the one who is known as the Word was there face to face with the Great Spirit. This Word fully represents Creator and shows us who He is and what He is like. He has always been there from the beginning, for the Word and Creator are one and the same. Through the Word, all things came into being, and not one thing exists that He did not create. Creator's life shined out from the Word, giving light to all human beings. This is the true light that comes to all the peoples of the world and shines on everyone. The light shines into the darkness, and the darkness cannot overcome it or put it out. Into the wilderness of the land of promise came a man named Gift of Goodwill. He was sent by the Great Spirit to tell what he knew about the light so everyone could believe. He was not the light, but came to speak the truth about the light. The true light that shines on all people was coming into the darkness of this world. He came down into this world, and even though he made all things, the world did not recognize him. Even his own tribe did not welcome or honor him. But all who welcome and trust him receive their birthright as children of the Great Spirit. They are born in a new way, not from a human father's plans or desires, but born from above by the Great Spirit. Creator's Word became a flesh and blood human being and pitched his sacred tent among us, living as one of us. We looked upon his great beauty and saw how honorable he was, the kind of honor held only by this one Son who fully represents his Father, full of his great kindness and truth. Gift of Goodwill told what he knew about him and cried out in a loud voice, "The one I have told you about is here. He comes after me, but is much greater, my elder. He has more honor, for even though he is thought to be younger, he existed before I was born. From the fullness of his being, we have all had many gifts poured out on us. Drawn from the water, gave us our tribal laws, but the gift of great kindness and truth came from Creator sets free, the chosen one. No one has ever seen the Great Spirit, but the one Son, who is himself the Great Spirit and closest to the Father's heart, has shown us what he is like." The Gospel of Christ.
Over the months and years that I've been preaching, every so often you'll hear me allude to the idea that the account in the Bible is focusing on what's happening with Israel and ultimately Jesus in the Middle East. And all of its history and references are focused there. But I've acknowledged that at the same time, there are peoples living in China and peoples living on Turtle Island over here. And the question comes, what's going on with them the whole time that the biblical narrative is unfolding? And this morning, I want to explore that a little bit more, as you might expect, in particular, thinking about the First Nations on Turtle Island, because, of course, what became known as North and South America, the New World, was not even known to exist yet, apart from the people who actually lived there. You see, the biblical account has a very small world. We acknowledge in the Bible that God is the creator of the world and all things come unto being from him and so on and so forth. But the world in the Bible is actually quite small. And I'm going to suggest necessarily so because it's at least 3,000 years old for when it started being written and 2,000 years old when it was finished being written. The Bible does talk about all of the earth being God's. And it belongs to God, and that peoples all around the world belong to God. But even that statement is limited. Genesis chapter 10 provides for us something that is referred to as the Table of Nations. And the idea behind the Table of Nations is to show where everybody ended up after the flood. So the flood happens, and all of humanity is killed off, and only 8 people survive: Noah and his wife, and then Noah's 3 sons and their wives. And so the Table of Nations describes the descendants of Ham, Shem, and Japheth, the 3 sons of Noah. And when you read chapter 10, you discover that, well, after we take these ancient place names and understand what the modern equivalent is of all the places that are listed there, we find that the descendants of Ham essentially populate Africa. The descendants of Shem populate Asia, and the descendants of Japheth populate Europe. Now, of course, those 3 names are not actually used in the scriptures at all, but that is where these ancient place names are referring. But even having said that, when we bring up Africa, for example, as far as the scriptures are concerned, we're only dealing with Northeast Africa, not the entire continent. When we're dealing with Asia, it's really just the Middle East and Turkey, which was called Asia Minor then. And when it comes to Europe, the farthest we really get is simply Eastern Europe surrounding the Black Sea, and then, of course, the Mediterranean hitting up, you know, Rome and Italy, of course, and then there's the suspicion that Tarshish is referring to Spain at the western end of the Mediterranean Sea. That's the world, as far as the Bible is concerned. Now, there is a blanket statement at the end of this passage, or at one point in this passage in Genesis chapter 10. It says, "These are the families of Noah's sons according to their genealogies in their nations, and from these the nations spread abroad on the earth after the flood." But again, that statement is very limited to that localized region. The writers of the Bible have no concept of Turtle Island. They do not know the New World. They don't even know that there's land there, let alone any people. As a result, apart from a general statement about the world belonging to God, there is nothing specific about what's happening with the First Nations. And conversely, there's nothing specific about what's happening with people in China either, let alone Australia. That is because this is the context the Bible works from. But it raises a good question. What's going on with these peoples over here while we see the focus of the Bible's narrative being on Israel and ultimately Jesus, and then what happens when the apostles begin to spread the gospel and pretty much focusing on Europe in the pages of the scriptures? What's going on out there? Well, it's helpful for us to begin by understanding a little bit of the timeline of what we're talking about. So 12,000 years ago, Mesopotamia began to be farmed and settled. Mesopotamia is the region around the Tigris and Euphrates rivers where modern-day Iran and Iraq are. This is where everything gets started as far as the biblical account is concerned. But it was 12,000 years ago that that region started to be farmed and settled. At least 11,000 years ago, First Nations appeared here in the plains region of what is now known as Canada. Where we are in southern Alberta, it was at least 11,000 years ago that people started living here. 8,000 years ago, there starts to be evidence of an early form of writing that would become the Chinese languages. 7,000 years ago, the Sumerians invent the writing that we count on in our Western civilization, the cuneiform alphabet that eventually leads to the languages that we use today. 5,000 years ago, Stonehenge started to be built in southeastern England. 4,000 years ago, Abraham shows up on the scene, according to the biblical timeline. 3,000 years ago, the kingdom of Israel is established. And of course, 2,000 years ago, Jesus makes his appearance. And so there have been people living here since 11,000 years ago. And what it is that we focus on in our scriptures started like 4,000 years ago, taking the idea of when Abraham, the father of Israel, started doing his thing. What's happening over here during the time before the Bible was even written and before the narrative of the Bible even talks? Well, we can learn things about our First Nations, brothers and sisters who have been living here. Some of the things are difficult to grasp and hold on to simply because the focus had been on making the use of storytelling as a way to pass on information rather than writing it down. Now, the technical term for that is oral tradition, and we often talk about the oral tradition that is foundational for the Bible. So every nation, before writing is invented, the only option you have is the oral tradition or storytelling to pass on what it is you want your descendants to know. And so no surprise that 11,000 years ago, the First Nations are telling stories just like the peoples who lived in the Middle East were telling stories way back then. It seems, though, that it took a while before First Nations began writing things down, so a lot of what we know about them and what they understood is still a product of the storytelling, the oral tradition that elders would provide. But of course, we realize as well that there were several nations here. That's how come we don't think of just one kind of indigenous person. There are many. In fact, here in southern Alberta, in the Treaty 7 Nations, and the treaties were established in the late 1800s, I'm not going to go there today, but we refer to them as the Treaty 7 Nations, there are seven nations represented just in southern Alberta alone, along with the Métis, which have their own history as well. Those seven nations have three different linguistic families that are represented. And so we have Algonquian and Siouan and Tsuut'ina as three different languages that are spoken by our First Nations brothers and sisters just here in southern Alberta alone. We should not be surprised that there is a great variety of understanding from the coastal peoples like the Haida and the Coast Salish and the Tsimshian and BC to the Treaty Seven Nations here to the Haudenosaunee, I think I pronounced that correctly, maybe I didn't, and the Abishag, I think is called, out in the east. There are all sorts of ways of being a First Nations person and understanding how you relate to the world and to the Great Spirit. So when it comes to trying to understand our First Nations brothers and sisters, there's a lot of variety. But having said that, there are some commonalities that were discovered all across the country. Generally speaking, the spirituality that developed among our First Nations were based on the idea, first of all, of the Creator, the Great Spirit. The idea that there is a singular entity responsible for all things having been made. We heard that in the reading of John chapter 1. I don't know if you picked up on the fact that it was John chapter 1 that was our gospel reading today. We were using the First Nations version of the New Testament to read that, and so that's why it sounded a bit different. But there's an acknowledgement of the Creator, the Great Spirit. Generally speaking as well, there's an understanding that all living things have a spiritual component and have spiritual power to an extent in a way that it might be described. Furthermore, there would be all sorts of rituals and ceremonies that the First Nations peoples would do. Whether we're talking about a rite of passage or a coming of age thing or just a celebration or a meeting of nations or what have you, there'd be ritual and ceremony associated with it, and it would most often have a spiritual flavor to it as well. This also gives rise to the fact that individuals would be identified as shamans. And First Nations shamans would be understood to be those that were healers. They would be the people who were custodians of their spirituality and their stories. They would be the people who presided over their ceremonies and would be the ones to give leadership in those things. They were their prophets, the ones who would be saying and speaking on behalf of the Great Spirit, and would even be ones who were diviners, looking for divine guidance about what life ought to be. Another rather popular part of First Nations spirituality is what's known as a vision quest. And a vision quest is when an individual would deliberately go off on their own in silence and solitude to practice prayer and fasting as an attempt to get in touch with the spiritual, to get in touch with the Great Spirit or perhaps another spiritual being. And when we look at these similarities in their practices with ours, we find that they are indeed quite similar. The role of a shaman isn't too different from the role of a priest. I wouldn't go around saying that I'm the healer for the congregation, but there is the liturgy in the BAS and in the Book of Common Prayer that talks about the use of anointing oil for prayers for the sick. I, of course, am the one who presides over our ceremonies. I am the one who speaks prophetically, speaking on behalf of God, as it were, based on what it is we read in the scriptures. And I am certainly one who is endeavoring to understand what God would have us do. And in that sense, I'm seeking divine insight and direction as to where it is we go as a congregation. The vision quest, anytime a First Nation person reads about Jesus' sojourn in the wilderness after his baptism, they see that as a vision quest. And even today, people do the same thing. Our spiritual disciplines of prayer and fasting and silence and solitude and seeking to get in touch with God is something we do. We may not go to the wilderness for it, but we have retreat centers all over the place to do the same kind of thing. And of course, we all share that commonality of understanding that there is a creator, one responsible for all things. Really, the biggest difference is the fact that we know about this person named Jesus, who emerged in this part of the world 2,000 years ago. And the First Nations, of course, had no idea what was going on in the Middle East, and so could not know that Jesus was there. So when we're asking ourselves the question, what was God doing with the peoples out here, when the Bible is focusing on what God was doing with the people right here, we have to wonder, would it be at all correct to say that God wasn't paying attention to them at all? Were they just killing time until missionaries finally got to reach out to them? For the 11,000 years that First Nations were living in North America on Turtle Island, were they just completely clueless and left to their own devices, and they had no idea about who God really was because they didn't know anything about Jesus? If that was God's intent and purpose, then generations of First Nations people have just died with meaningless lives, or with no certainty about their eternal destiny, or what have you. Or maybe the idea is, well, God is patient and generous to them, and until the gospel comes to them, then they don't have to worry, but the moment they hear about Jesus, well, now they're accountable, because now they've heard about Jesus. Well, once that finally happened, like 500 years ago, actually less than that, didn't go so well, did it? Yes, there are a number of First Nations who are Christians, who are Anglicans even, and are pursuing the way of Jesus. But the way it worked out when Christian missionaries arrived in Turtle Island, it tended not to be very positive. It tended to be quite the opposite. And if the idea was, well, now you've heard about Jesus, so now you're accountable for what you're going to do about Jesus, the fact that that message arrived in a very negative way on the part of so many, I think would be an unfortunate way for God to hold the First Nations people accountable for if they did not accept the gospel of Jesus Christ. What were the ways that people responded? Well, there were generally three ways that we could see people responded. I'm talking about European settlers, European missionaries coming to see the First Nations. One perspective is that the First Nations spirituality was very primitive and basic. It wasn't sophisticated. Obviously, they didn't know about Jesus, but even still, it was very, very basic. So there would be this spiritual arrogance, assuming that they knew nothing about what really was going on. And so let's inform them and teach them the way it really is to be a spiritual person. Another perspective takes it another step further and says, well, this has nothing to do at all with the Bible, so this must be demonically inspired, or these people are being deceived by Satan. And when they're doing their sweat lodges and dealing with their little medicine bag, and when they've got things like totem poles out on the coast, like, that clearly is bad. I mean, a totem pole, that's obviously an idol, isn't it? Because the Bible says, you shall not make unto thee any graven images. And a totem pole is a big tree log that has been carved into something. Clearly that has to go, and they would cut down and destroy the totem poles of the coastal peoples. Because to them, it was an idol, but they never stopped to find out that what a totem pole was never an object of worship. It's a pictorial representation of a story. The characters of the story are described on it. It would be a bit of a signpost indicating whose part of the land this is or what have you. It was never an object of worship. In fact, totem poles are essentially the same as stained glass windows in cathedrals. Because stained glass windows were there to tell a story in a pictorial way from the Bible. That's all that totem poles are doing. But no, we're jumping to conclusions. When I say we, I mean our ancestors. And we don't stop to find out what these things mean. And because sweat lodges aren't found in the Bible, then it's like, well, that's automatically got to be something of the devil. And a sun dance, oh man, that's just idolatry, isn't it? When there's a failure to engage with the culture and understand where they're coming from, it's very easy to say, that's different from what I do, and because I believe the Bible and I know I must be right, you must be wrong. But there was a third way that First Nations spirituality was talked about, and that was demonstrated by someone like Jean de Brébeuf, who was a missionary that came out to Eastern Canada in the 1500s. And he is one who took a rather different approach to Indigenous spirituality. He's the one responsible for writing what is known as the Huron Carol. And what he did with this carol was to tell the story of Jesus' birth using the context of the Eastern peoples, the Woodlands region in Canada. And so this is what he wrote in this Christmas carol we often sing. "'Twas in the moon of winter time when all the birds had fled, that mighty Gitche Manitou sent angel choirs instead." Of course, in the Matthew and Luke accounts of the gospel, and in Luke in particular here, God sends angels to announce Jesus' birth. Here, de Brébeuf is saying it was Gitche Manitou, which was an Eastern name for the Great Spirit. Great Spirit sent these angels. To whom did he send them? "Before their light, the stars grow dim, and wandering hunters heard the hymn." So now it's not shepherds, it's hunters, First Nations hunters that are hearing the announcement of Jesus' birth. "Within a lodge of broken bark, the tender babe was found. No notion of the stable and the manger at all, but a shelter that would be familiar to the Woodlands region. Jesus was born there. A ragged robe of rabbit skin enwrapped his beauty round." We read about Jesus being wrapped in swaddling cloths. And let me just tell you, there's no rabbits in the Middle East. But de Brébeuf said that Jesus was wrapped in rabbit skin. He goes on to say that chiefs from far before him knelt with gifts of fox and beaver pelt. They're not magi, their chiefs. They aren't bringing gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. They're bringing fox and beaver pelt as gifts. The point about what we see here is de Brébeuf evidently didn't think that the historical details of the accounts given in Matthew and Luke were all that important in communicating the fact that Jesus showed up. That the story of Jesus is about seeing God revealed to us in human form. And he labored to ensure that the peoples he came in contact with who knew nothing about Jesus could begin to understand something about him. What is it that Christians believe? And here he is, of course, talking about this about 1,400 years after Jesus had done, no, 1,600 years after Jesus had been there. And he's laboring to communicate to these people in a way that they would understand. Evidently, the historical details didn't matter so much as them getting the message about Jesus in a context they'd understand. What does that tell us about what is important about our faith? And what is it that really needs to be communicated? Does it have to be centered on the small world that the Bible has because that's all its authors can know? Or can we see what Jesus went on to teach and see it applied elsewhere? Not to mention all of the references to God in the Bible about how God is wanting people to know God and how people are seeking to know God and trying to find God. I mean, when you think about it, the way that we see the Bible being written isn't that far from how we could envision indigenous people trying to communicate their understanding of God. Our reading of Isaiah chapter 40, this is now still just from the New Revised Standard Version of the Bible. This is not the First Nations version. Imagine a First Nations elder, perhaps with the feathered headdress on, reading these words. Can you hear the words being genuinely from them? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them like a tent to live in. Scarcely are they planted, scarcely sown, scarcely has their stem taken root in the earth when he blows upon them and they wither, and the tempest carries them off like stubble. Lift up your eyes on high and see who created these stars. He who brings out their host and numbers them, calling them all by name, because he is great in strength, mighty in power, not one is missing. He does not grow faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the faint and strengthens the powerless. Even youths will faint and be weary, and the young will fall exhausted. But those who wait for the Great Spirit shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Let me suggest to you that the words of Isaiah the prophet are not far removed from the kind of language that we could imagine First Nations people on Turtle Island using as they endeavor to describe their understanding of the Creator, of God, of the Great Spirit. The gospel reading this morning, again, we read it in the First Nations version just to kind of change it up a little bit, and you heard different names of individuals being described as their translation instead, as a First Nation person would generally do. Jesus is called Creator Sets Free, for example. But there's something about John chapter 1 that's really important for us to grasp, and that is that, first of all, we understand the Gospel of John is the fourth of the Gospels written. It was the one that was written latest. And while it certainly includes Jesus' backstory about ancient Israel and Judaism, which was reflected in the Hebrew Bible, the majority of John's audience would have been Greek-speaking Gentiles, people who didn't have a Jewish background. So if you don't have a Jewish background, how much would you expect that you should know the Jewish scriptures? Not much. How much of the Quran do you know? Why would you? And so what we see in John chapter 1, actually, is a third creation story in the Bible. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and with him all things were made. Nothing that has been made without him. This is what gets said from the beginning. But what's exceptionally interesting about this passage is it isn't actually the Word. That's the English translation of the Greek word logos. And the Greek word logos is a Greek philosophical concept that emerged before Jesus came. And the word logos has to do with this understanding of the ground of all being, that which undergirds all that is. And so the writer of the Gospel of John is saying, in the beginning was the logos, and the logos was with God, and the logos was God. And he tells this third creation story from the context of the Greek-speaking peoples who understood this philosophical concept of the ground of all being, thus equating that with God, the Creator, who is ultimately incarnate in Jesus Christ. This is exactly what Jean de Brébeuf did with the Huron Carol. The bottom line is this: I am convinced that God didn't leave the peoples to the far east and to the far west on their own, continuing on in cluelessness and darkness, just waiting until maybe the gospel would finally reach their shores. God is everywhere. God is present all around the world. And though Jesus was limited in this area, and there's something to be said about his story when we encounter people that don't know him, that is not to say that God was not already present and at work in the peoples of the world. What would it have looked like if we took a different perspective than we did when Europeans finally encountered the First Nations here in North America? What if we were able to take that approach and go, oh, you guys are already here. We had no idea people were living here. What is it that you understand about the world? What is it that you understand about God? And then we would have a dialogue and hear them talk about the Creator and the Great Spirit, and we'd hear about ways that they were practicing, and we would see that's quite similar to the kind of thing that we're doing. But then we could offer to them something they did not know. You know what? We understand about this guy named Jesus who revealed God in a very, very special way that nobody else, like nobody else had. Let me tell you about him. And from them, we could learn as well something else. Perhaps most notably, an idea how better to live as part of creation rather than trying to dominate and control creation, which has been a tendency of Western civilization. We could learn from both sides. We could come together and see these differences as being a marvelous display of diversity because God is creative. I've gone on for quite a while, but let me encourage you to ponder these things. Really, the bottom line comes down to this: how big is God to you? Does God leave anybody in the dark and in the dust? Or has God always been speaking? And have people down through history, long before the Israelites ever showed up, been able to come to comprehend something of the one responsible for all that is and that shall be? Amen.